This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Troy Swanson, sitting in for Steve Thomas. My guest today is David Beard. He's a contributing editor to Poynter.org and writes their morning media wire. He has a distinguished career that includes working as former digital content editor of The Washington Post, editor of Boston.com, and executive editor of Public Radio International's PRI.org. He has also covered Latin America and the Caribbean as a foreign correspondent for the Associated Press.
With library budgets constantly shrinking, it's getting harder and harder to provide the resources your library patrons want and need. That's why the folks at Mometrics Test Preparation created the Mometrics e-Library. Through their e-Library portal, Mometrics offers study guides and practice questions for over 1,800 different exams covering college entrance, graduate school, nursing, medical, teacher certification, civil service, I'm counting this on my fingers, I'm running out of fingers, and many other careers and fields of study. All fully customizable and at a fraction of the cost of printed books. It's like having an entire library of test prep materials all at your fingertips. So, save space, save paper, and save money with Mometrics eLibrary. To get a free demo and 10% off your first purchase, visit goelibrary.com and let them know you came from Circulating Ideas by using the promo code PODCAST. That's goelibrary.com, promo code PODCAST.
David, welcome to the show and thanks for talking to me.
Troy, thank you very much for inviting me to Circulating Ideas.
I wanted to talk to you as part of my ongoing series on fake news and libraries. And for our listeners, I wanted to mention that you and I had met at the No News Symposium this past spring at Simmons University. And I knew immediately that I wanted to talk to you and have you as a guest on the podcast. So thanks for making the time. To start with, can you tell us about the Poynter Institute and your work there?
Sure. The Poynter Institute is based in St. Petersburg, Florida. It was founded by Nelson Poynter, and he was the owner of the St. Petersburg Times and bequeathed his fortune to a public entity that would nonprofit entity to further the cause of journalism. So the Poynter Institute does a lot of best practices training on fact checking, on leadership, on nuts and bolts of journalism and information gathering. So it's sort of a best of for practices in journalism. And I do something called the Morning Media Wire, which is both a scan of some of the stories that might be of interest to the journalistic community and the knowledge community. Actually, I see the community as journalists, I see it as academics, I see it as librarians, I see it as Wikipedians. So people who touch content in one way or another, I think are interested in a lot of these issues.
I start most of my days reading the morning media wire, and it's really fantastic. It blows me away. So let me jump and ask you about that. How does that process work? And also tell us about the Mother Jones Recharge newsletter. I'm on two of your newsletters, and I love them, and I think librarians should know about them.
Okay. If you're a librarian, you will probably know that the Poynter Media Wire has a certain focus, or at least I have a certain focus on it, to sort of reward, pay attention to people who don't generally get the spotlight in journalism. So it may not be the reporter you might see on Fox News or MSNBC at night. It might be the researcher or librarian who is behind some of the huge stories this year, such as the Rob Porter, that was a White House aide who had beaten two previous wives and had to resign, or a lot of the Internet Research Agency or Bureau from Russia. A lot of those stories were broken not by, say, journalists, but broken by researchers or people who had IS or LS degrees working in newspapers. And just tomorrow, I'll be showing the promotion of the former director of research of ProPublica. She works as sort of a right-hand person to John Oliver right now, and she's leaving John Oliver to be a story editor for the New York Times TV show. It's going on FX and Hulu called The Weekly, where it's basically news segments behind the news and other things that are happening. So I wanted to say that researchers play a key role in journalism as we know it. So, and that helps I'll get tips from the community on changes like that. So that's one little part that flavor that might be different. But every day I try to begin with an original story of some original reporting of somebody up top who's doing something fascinating, whether it's a person who has delved into the archives to find the greatest hits of 160 years of the Atlantic, or somebody who has merged history and journalism in a podcast, Slate's Slow Burn podcast, which I'm featuring that host tomorrow as the second season of the podcast is underway.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about the Mother Jones Recharge newsletter? I enjoy that one quite a bit.
Sure. I began recharge. It could mean like just recharging your batteries, or it could mean charge again for what you know is decent and right. But I began it as a sort of a Saturday passion project on Twitter, where I would just create a series. I would say my social media feed looks pretty dismal and depressing and all Trump all the time. And I thought there had to be another world out there, a world of normal psychology, a world where justice occasionally prevails, where people do things for other people and discoveries are made that can help other people. So it's not like a dog or kitten returning home, not one of those like feel good stories, but it might be stories on people doing the uncomfortable thing to help other people. It's a weekly newsletter. But what happened after I experimented on Twitter, Mother Jones got in touch with me. And now I do this. I get paid to do this now. My passion project is now a paid weekly column for Mother Jones. And I still do my Twitter Saturday project, but it's more of like a marketing thing. I want to see which stories really pop with my audience. And I'll put those sort of greatest hits in a Wednesday column for Mother Jones.
And if listeners wanted to find those, where would they go?
It's very easy for Recharge. It would just be Recharge and Mother Jones. So if you just search that, you'll pick up the page, like a topics page, but right at the top is a one-step sign and just give me your, you know, here's your email, and Gmail or whatever, and they'll send it to you. It's free. And for Pointer, you can just check Pointer newsletters or hit Pointer Media Wire, and you might get one of my columns, and there are two places there where you can sign up.
Well, let's kind of take a step back to the big level of journalism. Since I have such an expert, I don't want to lose this chance. A couple questions I wanted to ask. To start with first, you know, in the last 15 years, we've really witnessed the collapse of local news especially, but also significant consolidations at the national level. And, you know, I think a real scramble on, you know, how does this business model work for journalism? I was wondering just get your opinion, like, where are we standing now with journalism? What is the health of the industry?
Yes, I think that for some of the very big papers, New York Times, Washington Post, this is a pretty good time. The Washington Post has all the engineers at Amazon's disposal to find ways in which they can get you to sort of upsell, you know, a subscription into other things for them. They've grown and prospered. And for small papers, there are many who have been very creative. And I live in the Boston area, and there's a group of North Shore papers. Maybe the newspapers themselves, the small town papers, might have an average age of about 70 or 68. The local website may not throw off a lot of money from advertising either, but they're able to keep it going, the ownership group, because they have a series of, I would say, of glossy magazines, of sort of high to sort of rich zip codes along the shore. And the profits from that help pay for the other parts that I spoke of. So I think it's up to owners to kind of think creatively about how they're going to make the money to do this thing. And it's not always evident. It's not always in a for-profit situation. But yet, if it's a nonprofit, you have to move beyond the continual hunt for money or the short-term project so that you can hire a staff that won't be there for just a six-month grant. So there are all sorts of challenges on the small level. I think the hardest of all is probably the middle, is the kind of Chicago Tribunes and the Denver Posts of the world and the San Jose Mercury Newses of the world, because they're small enough to have this engaged to really know their readers, to really have a community feel so close to them. It's maybe impossible in a huge metropolis. That's an advantage the smaller publications have, but they're not big enough to compete nationally in scale with the likes of the Post or the Times. It's really, really rough. So that's why I began looking to, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I was on a Shorenstein fellowship and began looking at libraries. And I thought, if some of these publications disappeared, who would be around still to generate even the most modest part of what you would call journalism, say a local listing of events or a local listing of clubs? I've been looking to see where there are intersections with libraries. I think that librarians and journalists will be joined together in one of about 15 or 16 different ways. I've been writing about different places around the country that have different types of sort of pioneering libraries that have said, we're going to do a little more. There's nothing else here. Or the job of news has been thrust upon them.
You know, you and I had some conversations just about the potential for local media, for lack of a better term, that libraries as a information infrastructure, the ability to do a podcast, ability to record a video, and maybe the ability then for libraries to be the distribution hub. And I think there's a lot of places that are experimenting with those kind of models. So maybe it's not strict news reporting, but maybe it's community information that used to arise through one avenue that's now gone. The library may be able to fill some of those gaps.
It's a sense of vitality of a community. You can actually see that happen. Whether journalism in the Washington Post investigative All the President's Men scale happens or not, and it probably won't. It builds a certain other type of journalism that coheres a community, much like a library does anyway.
Right. I think there's a great deal of potential there for sure. Clearly, we're undergoing some sort of change. Do you have any forecasting sight that maybe could help us think about where we may end up that may impact libraries and may impact journalists?
Well, if I look in a way that kind of looks beyond the silos of the occupations, what do we need? And we need people to tell stories. We need project managers or editors or schedulers of programming to create a routine for dissemination of information, someone to administer the workflow. So it may be a pro-am kind of approach where maybe the library is simply the venue. There is a volunteer project manager, a retiree with experience in this field, a list of volunteers who could create content that may or may not have space weekly in the library on a table or in a room, or could work elsewhere. But at the very least, maybe the library is a distribution point for print versions of this, or whoever does the library weekly email could cross-link to this. It could be a second scenario is training. Can we train incoming and mid-career librarians, help them recruit sort of a day-to-day editor, or encourage them, much like they would seek volunteers for book clubs, to seek volunteers to writing courses or other things where they just stand and look at this or put the presentations or stories on a wall. I think there are any number of flavors that this could be. So what there may not be is training. Should you be doing content creation? How do you, maybe the training is more in recruitment. How can you recruit others to content create? And you can guide along the process, or perhaps provide a venue when needed, or something. So maybe finding different templates for ways in which the story of a town could get out. By story, it doesn't have to be journalism per se. It could be running memoir class. Some libraries got funding for oral histories of veterans through the VA. So there might be places that already have some recording equipment or have expertise.
And you know that with the public events that libraries already do, there is a great potential there. And part of it is taking things you already do and figuring out ways to capture it and put it out in maybe more of a purposeful and organized kind of way. Could I just step back to that larger journalism question? I did want to ask, you know, I sometimes feel like journalists are punching bags for political partisans, and that's partisans on the right and the left. I mean, I think clearly right now, Donald Trump may be the most famous of those, but I don't think the left is immune. I wanted to ask about just your feelings, like how are journalists weathering this political environment?
Yeah, I do think it's both more stressful and at the same time, there's a greater sense of purpose. Movies such as Spotlight or, there was a recent poll that says 59% of Americans, including a plurality of Republicans, say news and journalists are vital as sort of keeping a check on the Trump administration. So, and a desire for accountability from one side or the other. Journalists feel greater sense of purpose now, but it's harder. Newspapers are only hiring about a half of the journalists as they were a decade or so ago.
Interesting to me to see how many people we've hired recently. I work at a college, folks that have a background in journalism. So a videographer that used to do videos for the local newspaper that went under, writers that used to be paper writers, you know, and so it's in the kind of myopic, short-sighted kind of view, it's been good for us. We've brought in a lot of talented people, but it's also, I can't help but be a little sad when I hear their stories of how the industry kind of crumbled around them and they scrambled to find, you know, other places to go.
I mean, in some ways you've got survivors with you. You've got people who have had reverses and are still punching. So they may have a vitality. Journalists are very good at sort of quickly assessing a situation and trying to get some content out. So maybe the speed and the productivity of people might be startling at first.
Yeah, that's probably true, especially for higher ed, but we won't go into that. One of your recent, the Media Wire, you quoted a poll that said 43% of Republicans want to give Trump the power to shut down the media. So, you know, you did mention how people do want the media to be a check against government, but it also, I also worry about some of these other undercurrents that are going on.
Right. I mean, the caveat in that question was media that was acting badly. Now, it was vague what acting badly meant, and also vague as to who would be the judge of if they are acting badly, you know, if it's just Trump. There are some people who would say acting badly could be like Alex Jones, or could be some super irresponsible leftist publication too. When you go down to brass tacks, a much smaller percentage of people would say, no, Trump, you can shut down CNN or the Washington Post or the New York Times. It is still scary that there are a number of people who think that they need a strong man to without checks or balances. If I can go back to one point I didn't mention about recharges, I think that there might be some exhaustion among librarians. A lot of times journalists like librarians end up doing all sorts of extra jobs. I'm sure that Maggie Haberman didn't want to be doing Twitter into all hours of the evening for those years, or a lot of these people are working 15 hours a day. Much like journalists, much like librarians have had to take on any number of social service type roles as there have been either cutbacks in other places, or if it's the only venue where you can get a GED or ESL course now that it's not offered someplace else. I think there's a tiredness among folks, and sometimes a wish that things could go back to just what was my primary job again. I also think that among readers, there's an exhaustion over, like, can they really be destroying, you know, from the left, can they really be destroying our republic five different ways in one day? You know, how many fingers do I have in the dike to sign petitions to try to stop that? Or from the right, why are they frustrating all this change that we want? I think journalism has to broaden its sense of what is it and what does it provide, and has to really market itself every day, much like librarians do, as what's the service in the community. You know, the little slip says you've checked out $185 worth of materials so far this year, and your taxes for the library are $300. So pretty good deal. You know, we've got some months to go. That's the accountability on the library side. On journalism side, I think that they have to show stories that aren't about Trump, stories about people in the community who do good things that help others, and show step by step how a community teach a community, lead a community on how it's cool for one person to help another person.
And do you think that in order to do that, there needs to be some sort of resistance to the attention economy? I mean, I feel like sometimes we fall into this, hey, look at this. And, you know, when you get revenue by clicks, there's a certain lowest common denominator of headline sharing, attention grabbing. And do we need to kind of step back a little bit, aim toward more long form communication, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think everybody is stepping back. I mean, the ad model of paying for clicks basically collapsed. So it's not as worth it for places to show massive readership, people who don't even know what your video is compared to some other company's video. There's more of a drive to get people to be regular customers, understand what a media site is trying to do, and to sort of buy into the mission of preserving a community or serving as a watchdog for government officials or promoting programs that can help more people in the community. So I think that both librarians and journalists probably have to do a better job of selling themselves and actually showing the value of what they do. It's a lot of it we assume that the customers know, but they don't.
Almost more of an NPR kind of model.
Yeah. And which is happening in a lot of the, I could say there's some really super healthy places out there in the nonprofit realm, places like ProPublica, which announced today it's going to fund another 7 local reporters in places around the country. People really, they'll focus more on state government and state houses, but they've got additional money for that. Or Texas Tribune, which raised additional money to have 2 reporters at the border after the migrant family separation crisis and the refugee and asylum seeker and migrant crisis. They needed to be there to witness what was happening, and their readers agreed and helped fund that. That a lot of places, whether it's The Atlantic or Mother Jones, are also now funding new national security editors and reporters to just say, how does our government work, or what's going on with Mueller or with other things?
A few months ago, the Chicago Sun-Times had on their website a blank page and kind of said, we need your help or we're going to go away. And you're going to have one major regional media machine, which is the Tribune, which has its own problem. But I do feel like that sent a sort of ripple through at least the region of recognition that we do need this other voice besides just the one major paper. And maybe, right, you know, that's part of that appeal, like, to the community. Join us, be part of us.
And it's up to the media outlets to also listen, because they can easily sprout the message. But if they're not listening or taking feedback, it's customers will soon recognize that it's a one-way street and they're not being respected. So I think there are ways in which even smaller places in Chicago, like Chicago Block Club, is recognizing their individual subscribers. Thank you very much for your idea. You know, here's what we've done on this or something. There's an extra effort there.
And do you think that the burgeoning podcast market has potential? Obviously, we're on a podcast, so maybe we're a little biased. But I listen to a number of podcasts, and I hear them also asking for Patreon support. And, you know, if people have a limited media dollar, are they eating other people's lunch, or are they expanding the conversation?
I think they're expanding the conversation. It's just that time is finite. So you may have a very conservative audience that settles in on favorites or is loaded down, unwilling to try. I think it's a place where you have to, again, sort of campaign every day and presume that your readership, your listenership is transitory. And you have to make the case why your podcast matters and should be in the list of 4 or 5 regulars they might collect, unless they're inveterate exercisers or long haul commuters or other people who have a lot of time to listen.
Dave, while we're talking, I wanted to bring up the No News Symposium that was last spring, which was fantastic. And just for our listeners, that brought together librarians, journalists, and other related media and technology folks. That was done through an IMLS grant. I wanted to ask you about, what were your major takeaways? What did you pull away from that weekend?
First, I want to tell your listeners, it's K-N-O-W. So the homonym doesn't mean without news. It means understand
yes,
news.
Yes, good point. Good point, yeah.
And it hits some of the things like fact-checking and news literacy that are key components of libraries. And in places like the Poynter Institute, where I've been working, it's a super huge function of what it's doing also. So I think that a big takeaway was many efforts of different types could be needed, whether it's a couple evening events or it's a class or it's outreach into the community to both on a lot of the news literacy, not a lot of the fact checking that you've talked about, but maybe Matt disguising that and taking a really big event and then just saying, what do we know? What's a fact and what's a supposition? And sort of finding ways to be opportunistic and seizing the day there. Another takeaway I had was the need for intersectional training for information science students and journalism students. I think there is some sort of orientation of some sort. Maybe it's a talk in a class or something, but it's probably very inadequate to the news gathering and library skills in the future. I think there are going to be a segment of jobs. As you mentioned, some of your hires came from the journalism world, but it may be that a requirement for a certain level of newer library employee might be running newsletters and doing some sort of communication. Both that would both promote what's coming up, what would know what we've done, and maybe branch out from just the library per se. But you don't want to have, a video specialist or that's our token journalist, somebody in a silo. Ideally, it would be somebody who would be able to share and teach skills to a broader library population. Likewise, I think I'm positively modeling the sort of roster of Pulitzer Prize winning editorial research in libraries who are making the very best of journalism possible. So I definitely think that what you're talking about after Simmons' meeting was some sort of curriculum broadening that might teach librarians maybe how to be more of a hub and spoke for a project that might involve content, and then teach journalists some great skills in the LS and IS world.
I was really struck by the just the kind of mutual admiration between the professions. And I think there was a strong feeling of those 2 days that we were kind of in this together. One thing that did come up is, you know, the efforts to fight fake news, quote unquote, fake news, however you want to term that. That seemed to be a shared mantra. And I think it's probably not just a mantra between librarians and journalists. And I wanted to ask you, do you feel like we're winning this struggle?
I think you can make a case either way based on sort of inductive data. If I were to put the pessimistic view to a test today, I would cite something like Italy's upper house voting to remove mandatory vaccination for school children based on like fake news by anti-vaxxers and what implications that would have for the health of the school age population in Italy. And just so I think there are perils to fake news adoption all the time. I think there's a redoubled effort among journalists and clumsily and inconsistently among tech company heads that something has to be done.
One thing that I fear is that we hit a point where no one believes anything. And I feel like when I started in libraries almost 20 years ago, if it came up on the web, people would believe it. It looked real. It looked legit. Like there took a certain amount of effort to post things online, and especially to post things that look good online. And now I worry that we've taken a 180, where in the past we believed everything that we came across, and now we believe almost nothing. And there's obviously there's a health to some healthy skepticism, but we need to also have ideals that are shared in order to work as a society. And
well, who do people believe? I mean, I'm sorry, you hit this all the time. People believe us, but they don't know what we do for librarians. I believe my librarian said, hey, that book you're reading for your book club, The Other Einstein by Marie Bennett, I read it. It's a great read. I read it in 2 days. I'm reading it right now. It's a great read. I'll probably get it done in 3 days. Said, maybe your book club would want to consider The Feather Thief. And I'm like, Yeah, you're right on this. I'm going to follow you on the feather thief for next month. I guess I would look toward local. I would look toward people trust. I would look toward people who have personal relationships with other people, and maybe they have a role at a grassroots level disseminating information that is verified and verifiable. I can't combat Facebook because I don't have Mark Zuckerberg's wealth or reach, but I can do something about my community.
If listeners wanted to connect with you online, what's the best way to do that?
Sure. I am at D.A. Beard. So it's like the first two letters of David and then beard, like a beard on your face, or as you say in Chicago, the beard, or D. Beard at Poynter, which is poynter.org.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Troy, thank you. I've had a great time.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of my place of work or the place of work of guests. For past interviews, visit circulatingideas.com and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. And help others find the show by leaving a rating or a review. You can follow the show on Twitter at @CircIdeas or like the show's Facebook page. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thanks for listening and keep circulating your ideas. Thanks again to Mometrics Test Preparation for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. To get 10% off your first purchase and a free demo, visit goelibrary.com and use that promo code podcast. That's goelibrary.com, promo code podcast.